We are holding on Memchet on the day, 8 lines from the bottom. We learned yesterday about a case where you have a bunch of kalim that are attached together. We have a bunch of kalim that are attached together in a makeshift way or sometimes a temporary way or whatever. For example, you have a bunch of clothes that that when you give them in to be washed, the laundryman sews them together with a bunch of loose stitches in order that none of them got lost in the wash. Or we had for example, a stove, a kira, where you have various kalim attached to the outside of it, which sometimes you find useful together with the kira. So we said that such things are considered connected together only d'rabbanan, and therefore we said that the chachamim made a distinction with them to show that if they're only tamei d'rabbanan. In the case of the clothing, for example, the distinction is that if they become tamei mes, then each one of them needs to be sprinkled with parah d'rumah water. So we would say that midrabanan, we would say that you have all these clothes that are sewn together with these loose stitches. If one of them becomes tamei, then all of them become tamei midrabanan. But when it comes to being attired, then you would have to have parah d'rumah water would land on each one individually. In the case of the kira, seeing as how it's a kli keres, and kli keres is not able to become tahor, then you have made a different distinction. According to the mayor, we said, is that if the stove becomes tamei by tumah touching it, then those other things attached to it become tamei as well, or vice versa. But if the stove becomes tamei only by tumah being in its airspace, which we know is one of the ways that a kli keres can become tamei, then the other things attached to it do not. Okay, so now we're going to continue on that topic. We're going to finish off that topic of things that are attached together sometimes and detached other times. Turn it up on them. We learn it a braisa. Masporas shoprakim, a scissors made of two pieces. Now what you have is, you know, the kind of scissors that we're usually familiar with day to day stay together always. No question, those are considered connected. But we're talking about over here, you have, for example, sometimes kitchen scissors like this are like this nowadays, where the two pieces actually regularly come apart and you put them together only when you need them, or you put them together only when you need them to cut. The Ismail Shorehitin, or the blade of a plane, a plane is a tool that woodworkers use to smooth out wood. If we were together, you'd probably ask what it looks like, and I'd show you a picture, but because we're not, I can't, you'll have to look for yourselves. But if you look for a plane, a woodworker's tool, you'll find it. In any case, it has a blade in the middle of it. And the idea is, and so again, nowadays, it's more common that you just leave it that way always. The blade always stays in it and is held in place with a screw. Apparently, in those days, the idea would be that you don't regularly do that. You would take out the blade when you're not using the plane. Anyway, the din is, the Braita says, chibur l'tumah ve'ein chibur l'hazar. Such things are considered connected together when it comes as far as becoming tumah. So that, in other words, if one blade of the scissors touches tumah, then both of them become tumah, but not as far as hazar, not as far as sprinkling them with parah d'rumah water. Namely, if both blades are tumah, then you're sprinkling it with parah d'rumah water, then the water needs to land on both individual blades. So the question is, like before, manashah. So now, Tosfos points out, unlike the case of the clothing or the thing attached to the kira or whatever, where the whole concept because one is tamei, all of them are tamei, is drabanan, here it would actually be daraisa. This that we're saying, for example, that if one blade of the scissors becomes tamei while they're attached, then both of them become tamei, that would be daraisa. And the difference is, Tosfos says, because in the case of the clothes or the kira or what have you, one piece does not depend on the other one. You don't have, when all the clothes are sewn together with those loose stitches, you don't have, the sock doesn't depend on the shirt or vice versa. All of them are all needed. The laundryman does it in order that none of them get lost, but the use of the shirt doesn't require the sock to be attached to it, or vice versa. And the same thing with the kira. A kira does not require to have those kalim attached to it. It's just a matter of convenience. As opposed to with the scissors, the way you use the scissors is with the two blades attached, and therefore that's a different kind of connection, and that kind of connection has important daraisa. But still the question is, in that case, then why is it considered connected only when they become Tomei, but not as far as making them Tomei? The more that's from the monitor. If you're considering them to be connected, then even when it comes to Hazar, you should say that if the water, if the Parah Adumah water lands on one blade of the scissors, then the other one also becomes Tahar. And if you're not considering it connected, because after all, the two pieces are regularly taken apart, after the literal manamilo, then it shouldn't be the case, even as far as Tumah, if one becomes Tumah, the other shouldn't automatically become Tumah. Okay, it'll become Tumah because it's touching it, fine, but it'll be a lesser degree of Tumah. Why are we saying that both of them have the same degree of Tumah as if they both touch the Tumah? The answer is, Amar Rava, like this. Dvar Torah, the Shas Malacha Chibur, Bein L'Tumah, Bein L'Hazah. The Minat Torah, the rule is like this, with scissors and things, with these scissors that come apart and other such things. Minat Torah, when you're using it, the Shas Malacha, when you're actually using the item, then Chibur Bein L'Tumah, Bein L'Hazah. Then the connection between them is a valid one for both purposes, Daraisa. So if while the scissors are in use, If one blade touches Tumah, then both of them are going to become Tumah. And when you're sprinkling it, if one of them is sprinkled, then the other one becomes Tahar. The Shaloi B'Shas Malacha, during the time when you're not using them, so they're still connected together, but right now you put them down and you're not using them, then we would say they're not considered connected for either purpose. So while the scissors are sitting on the table, Tumah touches one blade, the other wouldn't become Tumah Daraisa. And the same thing as far as Hazah. But the Gozru Rabbanan al Tumah Shaloi B'Shas Malacha, Mishum Tumah Shabashas Malacha, the Chachamim made the Gzeira as follows. Even when you're not using the scissors, you still have to treat it as though you are using it. Mishum Tumah Shabashas Malacha, because otherwise it may be confused with the case when it is B'Shas Malacha. So with the scissors, the Chachamim said, always, if you're going to start saying that there's going to be a distinction, is that we're going to keep the distinction, Daraisa, between when you're using them or not, and in one case the other blade becomes Tumah and the other one it doesn't, people are going to get confused, and they're going to think that always the other blade doesn't become Tumah. They're not going to realize that distinction between this pair of scissors was sitting on the table versus that one was actually being used. Therefore, they made that Zera, that always, as long as the two pieces are connected, if one is Tomei, the other one is Tomei, and vice versa. Mishum Hazah Shaloi B'Shas Malacha, and vice versa, when it comes to Hazah, given that Shaloi B'Shas Malacha, the Hazah on one blade, the scissors, doesn't work on the other, then again, the Chachamim were concerned that people are going to be confused and think the other way around, that even Shaloi B'Shas Malacha, even when the scissors are on the table, it would still work. So therefore, now we have, the result of it is that the Tumah is always going to go from one to the other, and the Hazah is never going to go from one to the other, and that way it'll be clear.
And the reason why B'Shas Malacha is more stringent than not Shas Malacha is what again?
Well, because since these pieces are needed to be with each other when you're actually using it, you can't use a scissors with only one blade. Therefore, only when they're being so. But on the other hand, they are regularly taken apart. So you have that distinction between whether they're actually connected, the difference is not, like we said before, as far as clothing and a stove and whatever, between whether they're physically connected right now or not, but whether are they actually being used right now or not. That would be the distinction, Daraisa.
Still, why is it more stringent only when it's connected than not?
Because once it's tummy, it's tummy. We don't mean, in other words, that when you disconnect the pieces, then the one that was tummy becomes tougher. What we mean is, in other words, that if the scissors are stored away in the drawer with each piece separate, and Tumah touches one of them, the other one's not going to become Tumah. Why should it? The Tumah didn't touch it. The Tumah didn't touch it. They're right now they're separate pieces. There's no reason for the Truma to go.
Yes, there is. There is a reason. You could say that with the Kavana, the person who uses the scissors has the Kavana to use them together. And therefore, you could argue, since Kavana is important in Truma, that even if only one blade is affected, is Tameh, the Rabbanan at least, the other one should also be Tameh.
Okay, but we don't do that. In fact, later on in our Masechta, we're going to get back to, on Daf Nun Ches, we're going to get back to this matter of Chibur L'Truma and Chibur L'Hazar, and we're going to say over there that the Rashi and Tosfos both mentioned over there that to that extent, Chacham didn't find it necessary to make a Gzeira. If the two pieces are separate, then you're going to have it. If they're touching each other in the drawer, then obviously, you know, one of them is going to become an Avat Truma and the other one is going to become a Rishon L'Truma or whatever. But we're not going to say, even though they're disconnected, that Truma should just go through the air from one to the other. There's no such thing. Okay, so that's that. Now, that ends off the discussion about kalim that are attached together. Now let's get back to matters of atmana, which is the subject of our parent. We said in the Mishnah, "Bizman shehin lachem." We said that there are a number of things in our Mishnah that you can't use for atmana because they're going to be moist hevel. They're going to add heat to the food, to the pot of food. So there are certain things we said. We had a list of five things that you can't use, whether they're dry or whether they're moist. And then we had four things, straw and grape peels and fluff and grass, only when they're wet, only when they're moist, the Mishnah says, but not when they're dry. So the question is, we have a question. When we say wet, when we talk, for example, about the grass, let's say, when we say that you can't use it when it's wet, do we mean lachin machmas atman? Do we mean only if it's wet, only if it's moist with its own natural moisture? Or do we lachin machmas davar acher? Or maybe we're talking about where they're moist because of something else. Rashi explains that if they have their own original moisture, then they're going to warm up things that are next to them more than if they're wet with moisture that came afterwards. So in other words, with grass, let's say the idea would be, so is it that only when the grass is naturally fresh and moist, then you can't use it, but once, let's say, it starts drying out, then you're allowed to? Or would it be that you can't do it regardless if the grass is wet with its own natural moisture, or if you poured water on the grass or whatever and made it wet, made it artificially wet, would you still not be able to use it for hachmana? So Rashi says that if they have their natural moisture, then they warm up things more than if they're artificially moisturized. The Rambam seems to say the other way around, and the Magid Mishnah, in fact, says, and the Magid Mishnah and the Lechem Mishnah, they in fact say explicitly that the Rambam apparently learns the other way around, that if they're wet artificially, then they heat up the thing that they're inside more than if they have their natural moisture. All right. Anyway, which is it? Is it one? Is it both? Or is it one? Is it the other? Or is it both? Tashma. Let's look at a Braisa. Let's look at the words of our Mishnah. Loy b'tevim, we said you can't eat straw, v'loy b'zagim, or grape peels, v'loy b'mochin, or fluff, v'loy b'asavim, or grass, v'zman shehen lachim, when they're wet. So we have four things that are listed when they're wet. Iyavik b'shlema lachim and machmas davar acher, if you're saying that even when they're artificially wet, shaker, okay, then we can understand. All those four things can be made wet. And the Mishnah is saying, when they're made wet, then you can't use them. Eli amat lachen nachmas atman. But if you're going to say that it means that they're wet on their own, the question is, muchin lachen nachmas atman hechmash kachafla. The question is, muchin, which is soft stuff, which is, as Rashi defined it in the Mishnah, it includes, for example, it includes cotton, it includes bits of fluff, it includes bits of wool fluff, that come off worn out clothing or whatever. So where do you have such things? Are lachin lachmas atman? Where do you have muchin that are naturally wet? Usually, by the time they become fluff like that, they're dry. The answer is mimauta debena atman. The answer is yes, you could find, because you have the muchin among one of the possibilities of muchin is little bits of wool that come off, that come off the animal. You have the mouter, you have the wool that is pulled off the bene acme that originally was between the animal's thighs, between the animal's legs. Now, that area is always sweaty on an animal. So therefore, and it's called mouter, by the way, because you can't, because it's a tight area, you can't really shear it off with shearing scissors like you normally would. So you have to kind of plug it out if you want it. But the point is that it's always wet. Rashi says because of sweat, but then Hanano also says because of the animal's urine, whatever it is. So it has natural wetness. But yeah, in other words, maybe the Mishnah means that if you were to take muchin from that, if you were to take little bits of fluff of wool from that area on the animal, which have their natural wetness from when the animal is alive, from its sweat or from its urine, then you can't use them for Atmana. But maybe the Mishnah would be implying that if you have muchin that were at one point dry and then you poured water on them and made it wet, maybe you would be allowed to. So not necessarily a proof. Okay. The question is, Vahod Tani Rav Oshia. Okay, let's also take into consideration what Rav Oshia learned in this connection, where he said, Tonin B'Ksus Yivesha or Peiris Yivashin. He says that you're allowed to do Hatmana using dry clothing or using dry fruit, Avaloi B'Ksus Lacha, Avaloi B'Peiris Lachin, but you're not allowed to use wet clothing or wet produce. Now, on the surface, Tosfos says the next Mishnah that we're gonna learn right after this doesn't make that distinction. But Tosfos says on the face of it, Rav Oshia is arguing with that Mishnah because the Mishnah just says that you're allowed to do tatmana with fruit or with clothing, and Rav Oshia is saying only if they're dry. Other Rishonim, I think it's the Ritva, explains that the Pnei Yeshua says that not necessarily are they actually arguing. It could just be that practically speaking, with these kinds of things, you don't usually use them when they're wet. You don't usually use wet clothing to do Atmana. But in fact, maybe the next Mishnah would be saying that if you did, it would in fact be also and therefore not disagreeing with Rav Oshia. Anyway, Rav Oshia says in a braisa, turn in the ksus yivesha or peiros yivesha. You're allowed to use dry clothing or dry produce to like wheat or whatever to grains of wheat to do hatmana. Have a loy ksus lacha loy peiros lachin, but you're not allowed to use wet clothing, moist clothing, or moist produce. So again, the question is ksus lacha machmasachmasachmasachmasachmasachmasachmasachmasachmasachmasachmasachmasachmasachmasachmasachmasachmasachmasachmasachmasachmasachmasachmasachmasachmasachmasachmasachmasachmasachmasachmasachmasachmasachmasachmasachmasachmasachmasachmasachmasachmasachmasachmasachmasachmasachmasachmasachmasachmasachmasachmasachmasachmasachmasachmasachmasachmasachmasachmasachmasachmasachmasachmasachmasachmasachmasachmasachmasachmasachmasachmasachmasachmasachmasachmasachmasachmasachmasachmasachmasachmasachmasachmasachmasachmasachmasachmasachmasachmasachmasachmasachmasachmasachmasachmasachmasachmasachmasachmasachmasachmasachmasachmasachmasachmasachmasachmasachmasachmasachmasachmasachmasachmasachmasachmasachmasachmasachmasachmasachmasachmasachmasachmasachmasachmasachmasachmasachmas you weave the cloth, the thread you make it out of is dry. And again, the answer is mimarsha d'beni atmin. Same thing as we just said, as far as that wool that was between the animal's legs, suppose that you were to pluck that wool, and then, right then, while it was still wet, you go and spin it and make cloth out of it, or, you know, keep in mind, actually, making cloth could also just involve pressing it into felt, which would also be considered cloth for most purposes in halacha. So whatever it is, you could have that by the time it reaches the stage of being cloth, it still has that natural wetness. And therefore, maybe the Oshia is saying that you can't use it then. Not necessarily is it talking about even when it's artificially wet. Okay, so the Gemara leaves the question open. Whether it applies to one or whether it applies to both. The Rambam paskins that both of them are also, whether they're naturally wet or whether they're artificially wet. Okay. Mishnah says, you can do hatmana of food on Shabbos with clothing, like we just said. So this is we talked about yesterday about using a towel. That would be an example of that. Over potatoes, you could use produce. For example, let's say you make a pile of grains of wheat or something and put the pot inside that. You're allowed to do that because again, none of those things are not moichet hevel. They don't add heat to the pot. They only preserve the heat that is there now. So therefore, that would be allowed on Erev Shabbos. On Shabbos itself, you can't do Hatmana at all. But you're allowed to use these things before Shabbos. The Kanfei Yona, you can use dove's feathers. Most of the Rishonim and Achronim say we don't daft to mean doves. The Mishnah is just mentioning dove's feathers, pigeon feathers, because those are typical to use. the Rashash wants to say that maybe it is dafka specifically pigeons, because he wants to say, you know, there's generally a bird has two kinds of feathers. You have the little downy feathers that are close to the skin, and then you have the larger feathers, which is usually what we think of when we think of feathers. We usually think of a larger one. So he points out that pigeons have very little of the first kind, and mainly their feathers are the second kind, and therefore maybe the Mishnah is saying you can't use the downy feathers, only the regular ones. Anyway, but again, most of the Rishonim and Achronim disagree with that. Anyway, so you're allowed to use that. Over the Sodas Shokoloshim, you're allowed to use sawdust. Over the Odas Shokishtamdaka, you're also allowed to use fine combings of flax. So we've mentioned before that flax, as it comes out of the flax, grows in the flax fibers grow in a stalk of a plant. You get them out of the stalk, and then eventually what happens is you get to a process of combing them out, and the combings then include little bits of the stalk that stayed with it, and you also have their little shorter fibers, that are going to be too short to be able to make thread out of. So such stuff like that is a good insulating material when you have enough of it, and you're allowed to use that to insulate a pot on Shabbos.
Haroshim is what?
Haroshim are carpenters, and the sawdust from haroshim means dust from carpenters, meaning sawdust.
Sawdust.
When odus and what you comb out shall pishtan from flax daka, which is fine. So even the fine combings you're allowed to use. Rabbi Yehuda osa bedaka o mate bagasa. Rabbi Yehuda says no, you can't use it. If it's fine, you can only use coarse. You can only use coarse combings. Actually, we're going to discuss in the Gemara the question: does Rabbi Yehuda mean as far as the sawdust as well? That is only allowed if it's coarse sawdust. We'll talk about that in the Gemara. Okay. But since we mentioned in the Mishnah about Tanfei Yona, about feathers of a dove or a pigeon, then we want to tell something in that connection. Same story. Amar Rav Yanai, first the halacha, tefillin tzrichim guf naki ke'elisha ba'al knafayim. Tefillin require you to have a clean body like Elisha ba'al knafayim. So we'll see soon why he's called ba'al knafayim. But first, let's define the halacha. What does it mean to have a gufna? Imaihi. What does that mean? What's that particular care that you have to take while you're wearing tefillin? Abaya omashala yafiach behen. Abaya says you have to be able to, while you're wearing tefillin, to control yourself that you're not going to pass gas. And that's the care that you have to take while you're wearing tefillin. Rava omashala yishan.
Why bahen means on the tefillin itself?
Bahen means in them, meaning while you're wearing the tefillin. In them, while the person is wearing the tefillin, he has to be able to control himself to not pass gas. Rava Amashala Yishan Bahen. Rava says a different definition. He needs to be able to control himself that he shouldn't fall asleep while wearing the tefillin. If he falls asleep, he might pass gas, he might have caries. But, in other words, Rashi says, Rava is makel against Abaya, and saying if it's just a matter of that he needs to be careful to not pass gas, most people are able to do that. Unless you have stomach trouble or whatever, you're able to do that. We don't consider that you can't put on tefillin unless you feel that you can control yourself, because most people, with passing gas, because most people can do that. So Rashi learns that what Rava is saying is, the only concern you need to have when you're wearing tefillin is that you shouldn't be so tired that you're going to fall asleep. But if you're alert enough to be able to keep yourself from sleeping, then we don't care whether then not we don't care. But obviously, if he passes gas and children, it wouldn't be good. But he doesn't have to be concerned about it, because the average person is not going to have that problem where they can't control themselves like that. Most people can. Tosfos learns differently, that these two are two separate things. Actually, the other way around. Abaya is being more makel over Rava. Abaya is saying, as long as he can be careful not to pass gas, then we're not concerned that he might fall asleep, because the person is not just going to fall asleep samazoi like that. Whereas Rava is concerned that he needs to be able to know that even when he's tired, that he shouldn't fall asleep. Okay. Anyway, the point is that that's the goof nucky that a person has to have when it comes to wearing tefillin. Interesting, by the way, this is one of the points that came up when Mirta Tefillin, when the Rebbe came out with Mirta Tefillin in Chok Zion, so there were from various quarters in the yeshiva world, there were various objections raised to it. The Rebbe dealt with them in a number of sichas. One of them was this question that you see that tefillin require gufnaki, and how do you know for sure that the guy who you're putting on tefillin with has gufnaki? And the answer was basically the Rebbe's answer, which is actually basically you can find a similar answer in Sefer Achinuch, is that the Sefer Achinuch says, you know, okay, there's a lot of things you could be concerned of. I mean, you're not supposed to be Masiach Das either. You also have a point. Toys just brings it up over here. Sometimes you have a person who wears tefillin and people think him to be therefore a frum yid and a trustworthy person, and unfortunately, we know it's not always the case. So you actually have the Sefer Achinuch mentioned. There were people who felt that you shouldn't encourage people to wear tefillin because you have all these considerations. The Sefer Achinuch himself writes that, you know, I understand where you're coming from. I understand your concern about the kedusha of the tefillin and so forth. But after all, putting on tefillin is a tremendous mitzvah and it has tremendous benefits for the person. And putting on tefillin itself is going to help the person. It can help the person to become more, to become closer to Hashem and to be more careful in the future with Torah and Mitzvah, and therefore it's a good thing to encourage it. In the generation before the Sefer Achinuch, actually the Snag, Rav Moshe Mikutzi, did a huge tefillin campaign. He went around to many communities in Spain and in France where people were being lax with the Mitzvah of tefillin and convinced them with arguments like this to start putting on tefillin regularly again. So the Rebbe discussed this in the Sicha, mentioned the Sefer Achinuch, and added also that, look, you know, I mean, in the same way as we're saying over here, that a normal person can control themselves to not pass gas and not to fall asleep. Just in the middle of things, especially, the Rebbe said, you know, even if you're going to worry about Machshavas Zaris, come on, you know, I mean, you're talking about the guy excited to be doing something new. He's not going to all of a sudden in the middle of that start having Machshavas Zaris or whatever.
Okay. What was the name of the person he could see?
Rav Moshe Mikutzi.
Where is it? That's in France?
Kutzi, whatever, it's a city in France, yeah.
It's a Tosfos.
Yeah, he was one of the later Balei HaTosfos, yeah. So in the mid 1200s, he went and started Mirta Tefillin 750 years before the Rebbe did, traveling around to different communities throughout in France and in Spain over there, and explaining to them about the importance of the Mitzvah of Tefillin, and don't be careless with it. Put on Tefillin every day. With that said, these things are why it is, you know, we know that in the times of the Gemara, people wore tefillin all day, and nowadays we only wear them by davening, because the fact of the matter is, it's not always so easy for a person to control himself, but we're not on the same caliber and the same strength as they were in the times of the Gemara, and therefore it's a very rare Baal Madrega nowadays who wears tefillin all day. Okay. Anyway. So we're saying that you need to do that like Elisha Baal Knafayim. Now, in the following story that we're going to quote about him, we don't actually see explicitly that he was careful with this. However, Tosfos says, given that, as we're going to say in the story, a mess happened to him involved in the tefillin, then it must be that he had a goof nuffy, because if that's so essential for tefillin, that if he actually had a mess happen to him involving the tefillin, then it must mean that he was careful with them. So what's the story? By my story, led Baal Knafayim, why was he called the master of the feathers or the master of the wings? Shapamachas Godra Malchus Yoimi Arashah Zera Yisrael. One time the wicked Roman government made a Zera on the Jewish people. Shakolamaniach Tzidin Yenakulas Moichai. That anybody who puts on tefillin, they'll take out his brain. They'll drill into his head and remove his brain, because the head is where you put on tefillin. So they wanted to prevent people from doing tefillin. But this Elisha was still putting on tefillin and regularly going out into the street. Now, how is he allowed to do that when it's a matter of the kol nefesh? Hold that thought, and we'll talk about that at the end of the story. Anyway, so he was wearing them and going out to the street. A certain Roman official saw him. A pastor is a name for a degree of Roman official. Saw him. Ross Mitonov, so Elisha started running away from the caster, but Ross Achra, because the caster is chasing after him. Now, he didn't necessarily see that Elisha is wearing tefillin, because we're going to see soon that Elisha, that the caster didn't actually know that he was wearing tefillin. But as soon as Elisha, you see a caster, you know he doesn't mean good things for you. So you start running away. So the caster is running after him. Aha, this guy's running away. It means he's got something. The Kivinchi, yes, right? As soon as the caster reached Elisha, not one Meroshev Ochsen Miyado, then Elisha took the tefillin off his head and put them in his hands. Obviously, we see from this, by the way, that the tefillin in those days were a lot smaller than we have them nowadays. If we were in this situation nowadays with our Lubavitcher Dalit tefillin, you wouldn't be able to fit them in your cupped hands. Anyway, Amalei Mazabi Yotcha, so the captor, the Roman soldier, asked him, "What's that in your hand?" Amalei Kansei Yoina, so Elisha says to him, "Pigeon, dove's feathers." So the guy made him open up his hands. Parsha took the other. So Elisha opened up his hands, and in this happened, the Nintu Kanfeyona, they found that in fact he was holding a handful of pigeon feathers. So in this happened, and the tefillin turned into pigeon feathers, and that saved his life. And therefore he is called Elisha Balknafayan in memory of that net. Now, we have to ask over here what's going on over here. First of all, a couple of the Tosfos starts by asking the question, what happened to Mr. Duff Nefesh? We know when there's a Shata Shmad, we know that when the Goyim are making a Zera that is deliberately trying to break Yiddishkeit, as obviously it was in this case, the Gemara in Sanhedrin explains that there's a distinction when it comes to the dinim of Yehorik Val Yaver. You have a distinction between whether it's Shata Shmad or not. When it's not Shata Shmad, then a person is only required to be Moshe Nefesh for the big three, of a Dezora Gila Arayis and Shrichos Damim. When it's a Shata Shmad, when it's a time when the Goyim are deliberately trying to outlaw Yiddishkeit and suppress it, then the din is you have to be Moshe Nefesh for any mitzvah, or even for any minhag, outside of Masana, even not to wear Goyish style shoelaces, as we famously know. So how is Elisha supposed to ask? Why is Elisha taking off the tefillin over here from his head? He should still continue wearing them, and yes, I'm wearing them, and yes, I'm going against your Zera. The difference is, if you were to, let's say, in a Shata Shmad, you were to, let's say, wear the Goyish style shoelaces, then you're showing, it's as if you're showing right now, I'm not a Yid, I'm acting like a Goyim. Well, when it comes to not wearing tefillin, not all Jews are wearing tefillin all the time anyway, as we just said, even in those times where many people wore tefillin all day, not necessarily all of them did. So therefore, a person not wearing tefillin is not demonstrating thereby that he's acting like a goy. Unlike, for example, a person who would wear the goyish style shoelaces if the government is demanding that you do that. With that said, what?
Can I ask you a question?
Let me continue, and then you can ask the question. With that said, though, Tosfos later on in the Sefta, at the beginning of the 19th parak, the Gemara also mentions the story again and mentions that tefillin is one of those mitzvahs that unfortunately is weak by the Jewish people because we weren't Moshe Nefesh on it. And Tosfos says that actually here you have an example. Even Elisha Bar Knafayim, who to begin with is walking around with tefillin on his head, nevertheless, as soon as the danger is right there and imminent and the caster is in front of him, he takes them off and hides them, showing that even he didn't have total Mesiras Nefesh with tefillin, says Tosfos over there. Now, on the other hand, a couple of the Rishonim, the Ramban and the Ran, ask the question the other way around. Why would we assume that he's required to be Moshe Nefesh for tefillin in the first place? If, like Tosfos is saying over here, he's entitled to take them off but he's not required to go on the Siddur Nefesh, because you could say, okay, the fact that he's wearing tefillin doesn't demonstrate that he's acting like a goy, then why, to begin with, is he going out in the street wearing tefillin? So they say that there's a famous Machloikas Rishonim on the question of whether, when it comes to a case where you're not required to be Moshe Nefesh, are you allowed to? The Rambam famously holds that not. The Rambam says if a person is Moshe Nefesh in a case where halacha doesn't require him to, then he's a shoifach damim, he's like a person who committed suicide, he gets no schar for it, etc. Whereas the Balei HaTosfos hold, and in a couple of places, that you are allowed to. So the Ramban gives a similar answer over here, that in other words, that Elisha is not required, you're right, Elisha would not be required according to that way of looking at it, which is the opposite of Tosfos' premise, is that Elisha is not required to be Mosa Nefesh for Tefillin, because even in a Shasa Shmad, again, because not necessarily is everybody wearing Tefillin all the time anyway, he could wear them in private when it comes time for davening like we do. However, he is entitled to be Mosa Nefesh for it, and that's what he was doing by wearing them out in the street. Then so that's what it is. I saw an answer also along the lines of that he was wearing them the whole time, but when the caster actually catches up with him, what's going to happen is whether the caster kills him or not. Either way, now the caster is going to be in possession of the tefillin, and that's going to be a bigger bazillion for them. So better he should take them off and hide them. Okay, now you can go ahead and ask the question.
So I have a true story relating to this. A friend, an Hungarian friend of mine, was traveling in a train trying to escape the Nazis when a bunch of SS officers were checking that train, came to his carriage, and he hid his tefillin by sitting on them, and he was saved. Now, I'm wondering, that's really pikuach nefesh. He would have been killed probably, I don't know.
Obviously, yeah. You're asking whether he was justified in doing that up the halacha. The pashtus.
No, not only that, but he told me that it's because he did that he was saved.
Okay. You know what? We learned in Brachos about a case where a person is riding on a donkey and carrying a Sefer Torah, where normally he's not allowed to carry it in a way that would be a bizoyan, but we said over there, if he's trying to escape from Gandavim or whatever, then he's allowed to carry it in a way that normally he wouldn't. And we talked over there about, actually, we have Rashi and Tosfos discussed over there the question, would he even be allowed, are we saying just that it's mutter to do it like in a way that's a little less respectful, but still basically respectful of the Sefer Torah, or is he even allowed, for example, to sit on the Sefer Torah if necessary, if he needs to get away from there in a hurry? Yeah, this, your case is similar to that. In fact, I think you brought up the same story. I think you brought up the same story there also.
And so halachically, over there it was a Sefer Torah. Here it's specifically tefillin. So that would be mutar.
Same thing. I mean, the kedusha of the Sefer Torah is greater than the kedusha of tefillin. So okay. Anyway. The pashtus, we would say that, yeah, I mean, pikuach nefesh is zoicha almost everything. Obviously, you know, obviously a person should feel bad and do a certain degree of tshuva for the fact that they had to sit on tefillin. But you know, I'm not a rav. You ask a rav if such a thing ever comes up in practice. Rahman al-Islam, or you ask him before, you had to ask him ahead of time. You know what to do in a time of pikuach nefesh. But the pashtus, you know, you also have to consider, of course, if the Nazi Yimach Shemayah had found him, not only he would have been killed, but the tefillin would have been desecrated anyway, which is similar to what I was just saying over here with Elisha, where he figured that, you know what, there is a, you know, we do have to wear tefillin as much as possible, but on the other hand, if the pastor ends up taking the tefillin, then they're going to be desecrated anyway, so therefore it's less of a desecration to take them off. All right, or in your case, to sit on them. All right, anyway, let's go on. So the question is, why indeed in the story did Elisha mention pigeon feathers, dove's feathers, rather than any other kind of bird? Why didn't he just say feathers? Compared to other birds, the reason is Mishum Imtil Knesset Yisrael Leyona, because the Jewish people are compared to a dove. Shenema Kansa Yona Nechba Bakesef Leymer, as the pasuk says, the wings of the dove covered with silver. It's part of Kapitel Samaches in Tilim, which talks about Matan Torah and Yitzhak Mitzrayim and other things that compares the Jewish people to a dove. And the comparison is, my Yona Knafel Meginus Aleha, just like a pigeon, a dove, its wings and its feathers protect it, which we'll explain how in a second. Afisrael Mitzvah Meginus Aleha, the same way the Jewish people Mitzvah protect them. In what way does a pigeon's feathers protect it more than other birds? So So Rashi explains, most birds, if they're fighting against an attacker, use their beak. A pigeon, instead, beats against the attacker with its wings and its feathers. So therefore, in that sense, the feathers protect it more than with other birds. Tosfos explains differently that you have most birds, when they're tired, they sit down a while. They perch on something. They go on the ground. They go on a tree or whatever to rest up a little bit. A pigeon, when it's tired, it continues flying, but temporarily it uses only one wing so it can rest the other wing. So therefore, in that sense, its wings protect it, that it's always flying away from danger rather than just hiding out like other birds do. So therefore, its wings and feathers protect it like mitzvahs protect the Jewish people. The Radak actually brings a very interesting explanation, which is that a pigeon, you could say, a pigeon is a kosher bird. Depending on some species of pigeons, meat is pretty tasty, actually. How is it that the person has pigeons and he doesn't just shech them and eat them? And the answer is because its feathers, its wings, save it, because instead a pigeon is more valuable, even from the Gaonim, a pigeon can often be more valuable as a homing pigeon. We know that pigeons have a great sense of home, and in fact people have used for thousands of years pigeons to send messages from point A to point B, because they know that the pigeon is going to afterwards return back to them. That's why he brings it. That's why Noah sent out a pigeon, a dove, to see whether the water or the marble is gone, because he knew that it will return to him. So therefore, in that sense, its feathers protect it. The fact that it's able to fly back to you is what protects it and prevents the owner from just shedding it and eating it, because it's more valuable to him as a messenger bird. Anyway, the point is, for any of those reasons, the feathers of a pigeon are a metaphor for Torah and mitzvahs, which protect the Jewish people, or for mitzvahs specifically, which protect the Jewish people. So that's why Elisha, when he's speaking to the caster, that's why he used the metaphor of doves, of doves' feathers. The Mishnah had said, "Vinisodas shocharoshim." We said in the Mishnah you're allowed to use sawdust for hatmana, and we said you're also allowed to use combings of flax. And then we had Rabbi Yehuda saying that you're not allowed to use fine ones, but you're allowed to use coarse ones. So the question is, Iboyelahu, we have a question. Rabbi Yehuda and the sawdust shocharoshim koi, or on the odas shopishan koi? Is Rabbi Yehuda referring only to the last mentioned thing, the combing of flax, or is he also referring to the sawdust? Is he saying that both when it comes to sawdust and flax combings, you can't use the fine ones because those are going to be most heavy, but you can use the coarse ones because they're not? Does he mean both of them, or does he only mean the odor of shopishan? But in other words, he would say sawdust, it doesn't matter whether it's fine or coarse. So Toshma, Tanya, we learn in a Braisa, Rabbi Yehuda Omer, the onus of Pishtan Daka Hariyu Kazevel, that Rabbi Yehuda, in a Braisa, Rabbi Yehuda says that fine combings of flax are like Zevel, they're like animal dung, which we learned in the first Mishnah, is also to do Hatmana in, because it is most of Hevel. And the point is, since the Braisa mentions only the onus of Pishtan, Shmamina na onus of Pishtan Koi, that shows that Rabbi Yehuda, when he makes the distinction between coarse and fine, is only talking about an odor shopishtan. Otherwise, the Braita should have had to mention that Rabbi Yehuda says the same thing about sawdust. So therefore, Shlamina, so that proves it, that in fact Rabbi Yehuda only has a problem with flax combing, that they have to be the coarse ones, but with sawdust, he doesn't care. It can be fine sawdust or coarse sawdust, and either way, you can use it for Hatmana. Okay. Mishnah thing. Continuing on the topic, so now let's talk about, further what you're allowed to use for Hatmana. We had a list in the previous Mishnah. Now we're not going to do a list of things that you can use for Hatmana. Now we're going to be talking about certain dinim that apply once you did Hatmana with things, those things intrinsically might be mukta. So what are the dinim then? So the Mishnah says, Tum b'shlochin, you're allowed to do Hatmana using animal skins. Meaning we're not talking about they were already processed into leather, they're just still raw animal skins, or metalphalanoisan, and you're allowed to move those on Shabbos, the skins are not considered mukta. Now we'll see in the Gemara that actually we're going to have to figure out. I mean, normally people take skins and process them into leather. Shouldn't they be mukta machnas chisar in kis? We'll talk about that in the Gemara. With that said, though, Tosfos over here distinguishes between whether the skin comes from a large animal like a cow versus a small animal like a sheep. Maybe when we're saying over here that skins are not mukta on Shabbos, maybe we're only talking about ones from large animals. Okay. Anyway, so you're allowed to move the skins on Shabbos because they are usable for a purpose. What you can do is you're able to use them to lean on. You're able to use them to lean on or to recline on Shabbos. So therefore, they're not considered mukta. But the Gizek Semer, on the other hand, when it comes to a person is allowed to use wool shearings for Hashmona, again, where he takes a pile of wool shearings and puts the pot inside it, the Ein Metal Benoisen, but you can't move the wool shearings on Shabbos because they're mukta, because they're usually you use them for spinning thread and making cloth. Kate said, Hu'oisa, so what do you do if you use Gizek Semer for your Hashmona? How do you get the food out of the pot? You take the cover of the pot off the hay nofus and the gizet semer fall out on their own. That you're allowed to, in other words, let's say the handle that you leave before Shabbos, you leave the handle of the pot sticking out of the gizet semer, and then on Shabbos, when you need the food out of the pot, you grab a hold of the handle, which is sticking out of the pile of gizet semer, you take off the handle, and all the gizet semer that are on top of it fall off. Or you have the Magen Avraham mentions another possibility. What if the handle is covered as well? Okay, you stick something in there. Move around the Gizei Semer, and then you uncover enough of the pot lid to be able to lift it off. Either way, that kind of thing is mukher because it's called tiltul menafsad. It's called indirect moving of mukta, and you're allowed to do that. Now, Rashi brings up the other point, though, which is, why don't we say that the pot lid should be a buffer for Dover or Osir? We talked about at the end of last time, that's the concept, that if you put a mukta item on top of something else before Shabbos, and you put it there deliberately, then we say not only the mukta item itself is can't be moved on Shabbos, but even the thing that you put it on top of, let's say the table or whatever, becomes mukta for all of Shabbos as well. Why don't we say over here that the pot lid is considered mukta because before Shabbos you deliberately put gizeh semer on top of it? So Rashi just explains that the pot lid is not made for that purpose. The pot lid is made for the purpose of covering the pot. In other words, in effect, what Rashi is saying, and this is how various Rishonim and Achronim understand Rashi this way, that what Rashi means is, in other words, that the lid is not bottled to the Gizei Tzemer because the lid's fundamental purpose is not to serve as a basis for the Gizei Tzemer, but rather to cover the pot. In other words, when we were saying the other day about bosses for Dabra Osir, we were talking about, let's say, for example, a lamp that has a flame on that lamp and oil and wick that have a flame on top of them, where the flame is mukta and all the other things are bosses for Dabra Osir, because those are made for that purpose. So that's their primary purpose over there is to serve as a bosses for that flame. Candles on a Shabbos table, let's say, okay, the table can hold a lot of other things, but the purpose of the table is to hold things on top of it, and therefore it can be a bottle to double, also therefore it can be bottle to the candles, as opposed to over here, the pot lid is not made to put things on top of. Anyway, so and then there's various other answers from Rishonim and Achronim also why it works. One of them is Tosfos in previous Perek talks about the possibility that maybe when we say something is a bus, it's a Dabra or Osir, maybe it's only if you're actually planning to leave the mukta thing there the whole Shabbos, but if you're planning to take it off in the middle or not, and here you're planning to take it off in the middle, because at some point you've got to get the food out of the pot. Okay. In any case, that's the bottom line, is for any of those reasons, as well as various others, the lid is not considered bus, it's a Dabra or Osir. Okay. Continues the Mishnah. Kupa, when it comes to the basket that you do that money in, now usually you're not just going to have, let's say for example with Gizei Tzemer, you're not just going to make a pile of Gizei Tzemer around the pot, because obviously they're not going to stay in place. So usually what you would do is you would fill a basket up with Gizei Tzemer or whatever other material you're using, and then you put the pot inside it, and then you put more Gizei Tzemer on top before Shabbos or something like that. So now what happens is on Shabbos, you have this basket, which is full of Gizei Tzemer, and within the Gizei Tzemer is the pot that you want. Now, again, the problem is the Gizei Tzemer are mukta, So what do you do as far as that? Kufa matalti. The Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah says what you have to do is tilt the basket on its side, and then take out whatever you need from the pot. Take your food. Because Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah says, don't actually take out the pot from where it is among the Gizeh Semer, because then when you take it out, the pieces might fall into the hole where the pot was, and then you're not going to be able to put it back because the pieces of wool are mukta. So therefore, Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah is telling you you can't do that. All you can do. So therefore, just tilt the basket. Open up the pot, take what you need, but leave the pot there where it is, so that the Jesus Temer don't fall in, and then you're going to have a problem that you can't move in. The Chum said that's not a problem. That's not a problem. You're allowed to take the pot out, and you're allowed to put it back in. And we'll see in the Gemara. Eventually, we'll see. What exactly of Elazar ben Azariah and the Chachamim are arguing on. I mean, they both agree that Gizeh Semer are Mukta. They both agree that you can't move them out of the way to put the pot back. So what exactly is the Machlokes? We'll see eventually in the Gemara. Okay. The Gemara starts out. Yud. This that we said about skins of animals, that you're allowed to use them for Hashmona. The Gemara says, Yosef Rabbi Yonasan ben Achinoi, Rabbi Yonasan ben Elazar. Rabbi Yonasan ben Achinoi and Rabbi Yonasan ben Elazar were sitting together. The Yosef Rabbi Chanina bar Choma Gabayu. Rabbi Chanina bar Choma was sitting together with them. And three of them had the question, some of them had the question, Shlochin Shabbala Bayisnan. When we say in the Mishnah that you're allowed to use skins of animals, are we talking about only skins that belong to a private person who is not planning to sell them? So therefore, if they get dirty, he doesn't care so much. So therefore, what you could do is, eventually, fine, you're going to use them. Eventually, fine, he wants to use them to have leather made out of them. But meanwhile, because he's not planning to sell them, he's just going to use that for his own personal use. He doesn't care so much right now if they get dirty. So he'll go ahead and use them on Shabbos as a makeshift mat or something to lean on. And then eventually, he'll take them to get tanned. So would that be the case? Aval shel uman, but when it comes to skins that belong to a professional who wants to sell them, and therefore he wants to keep them clean, given the kapid alayhu, since he's mastered on them to keep them clean, loy metaltalinamahu, maybe we would say we can't move such skins, because then those would be considered muktamachna chisorin kis, just like you said, for example, the other day about a shepet naik or whatever, something that you wouldn't use for any other purpose because it may get wounds. For example, again, these skins where you're planning to sell them and therefore you don't want them to get dirty would be muktamachna chisorin kis, another example. The shechita knife, another example. For example, let's say clothing, that's clothing in a store, that's for sale or whatever. You know, either the store owner doesn't just want you to wear that clothing stamazer because if it gets stained or whatever, then he can't sell it. So is that the case, that the skins we're talking about in our Mishnah is not the case if we're talking about a professional person who sells skins? Then you wouldn't be allowed to move them on Shabbos. Or maybe not. Maybe the Mishnah means even ones that belong to a craftsman, even ones that belong to someone who's actually going to sell them, because even he could use them. But choshken shabala bayis, and then all the more so, ones that belong to a bala bayis would be mutter to move on Shabbos. So which is it? Amalahu Rabbi Yonasan ben Elazar. So Rabbi Yonasan ben Elazar said to them, "Mistabra shabala bayis." It's logical to say, now we're only talking about ones of a bala bayis. Svara would tell us that an uman's skins are meant for sale, and therefore he's particular about them, that they shouldn't get dirty, and therefore, yeah, logic would dictate that the ones we're talking about in our Mishnah can't be the ones that belong to an uman. However, but then Rav Chanina bar Chama said to them, no, kach omer Rabbi Shmuel b'Rav Yosi. Rabbi Shmuel b'Rav Yosi said as follows, Abba, my father, Rav Yosi, was a tanner. Okay? He was a professional who tanned skins into leather. So Omar, and he said, "Haviu shlochin b'nei shvaleihen, bring skins and we will sit on them." Rashi explains, we're talking about on weekdays. On weekdays, Rav Yosi would regularly say, bring some skins over here bring some skins over here, and we'll sit on them. So we see that even though Rabbi Yossi is an uman because he's a tanner and he's selling the skins, nevertheless he didn't care if they get dirty, and therefore Rabbi Hanan bar Chama is saying. So you see that there wouldn't be the distinction. An uman is not picky, even an uman is not picky about such things. Therefore, they're not muktzeh machmas kasharintis. Tosfos learns differently. Tosfos learns from Rabbi Chanano. Now, what we're talking about, we're not talking about on weekday. We're talking about on Shabbos. Rabbi Yossi would tell people, come, let's bring me some skins, and let's sit on them. So we see that Rabbi Yossi held, but they're not considered muktzeh machmas kasharintis. Okay. Either way, the point is that Rabbi Chanina bar Chama is telling them this distinction that you want to make between skins that belong to a private person versus to a professional. There's no such distinction. Either way, they're not muktzeh on Shabbos. Then Gemara says, "Maybe I have a contradiction." A braita says, "Nisarin shabal abayis, wooden boards that belong to a bal abayis, mitalt lenosan. You're allowed to move them on Shabbos. They're not muktzeh because they have, even though again, he might want to make them into furniture or whatever, and he might not want them to get dirty, but not necessarily. A bal abayis doesn't necessarily care about such things, especially he's not going to be selling them, so he doesn't care if they get a little bit dirty. So therefore, they're not muktzeh." The shop woman in the top of the night, but boards that belong to a professional, who's going to be selling them, in the top of the night, then you're not allowed to move them on Shabbos because muktzeh concerns it. Being chishiv lif losses our land passport or thing. If you thought before Shabbos that you're going to use these boards to use them to give bread to guests, in other words, that you're going to use them, they didn't always have plates, individual plates in those days. Sometimes you'd have like one big board on the table, like nowadays you have a big serving dish or something, and everybody would just take and eat directly out of that. So if, let's say, you decided before Shabbos that you're going to use this board as a bread board on your table, then either way you're allowed to move it on Shabbos, because now it's not muktzeh. So the point is, we see that when it comes to wooden boards, there's a difference between whether they belong to an uman or a bal abayis. For pashtus, we would assume that the same thing applies to skins. And the answer is, everyone says, no, shining a star in the kapit alayu. No, you can say it's different when it comes to boards because the person is more masked on them. Because boards, you can have, it's very easy. It's very easy for boards to get ruined. Because a splinter could come off them, they could get bent, they could get dented, etc. As opposed to the skins are a little more resilient than that, and therefore you could say that maybe even an omen doesn't care so much if you use the skin to sit on the ground or something. It's not going to get damaged to the extent where any potential buyer would care about it one way or the other. So we're not done yet, but okay, we see therefore that the distinction that Rabbi Chanina bar Chama had made, quoting Rabbi Shmuel bar Rabbi Yossi, the non-distinction could still be valid, that when it comes to skins, it doesn't matter even ones that belong to an omen or not. Toshma, let's look at another braisa. Oros, animal skin, bein avudin or bein she'ein avudin, whether they've been processed and made into leather or whether they haven't been processed, mutzel l'kalpel on the Shabbos, you're allowed to move them on Shabbos. Loy omru avudin elo l'inyan tumo govad. When the Chachamim mentioned the concept of skins that have been processed versus ones that have not, you should know that distinction is not in connection with Hilchos Shabbos. It's in connection with the halachas of Tumah V'Tahara, namely that an unprocessed skin is not makabel tumah, a processed skin is. But only in that case do you have that distinction. But otherwise, when it comes to Hilchos Shabbos, there's no distinction. The Tosfos discusses over here whether we're talking about whether the skin, if you designated the raw skin to sit on, then actually it could be makabel tumah already. But here we're talking about where you didn't. Here we're talking about the stam of skin where you decided out of the blue to use it to sit on, so it's not makabel tumah if it's not processed. Okay. Anyway, the point is the braisa.
What do you mean by processed?
Made into leather. They're canned and made into leather.
completed process.
Well, not necessarily completed, but at least that you started the process. But the point is, the Braise is saying that when it comes to Hilchos Shabbos, it doesn't matter. Whether it's unprocessed, whether it's fully processed, but Pashtus, even if it's in the middle of the process, I don't know. Either way, it's not Mokseh. So since the Braise doesn't make a distinction, my lav, shouldn't we assume that it doesn't matter whether it belongs to a Balabayas or an Oman? The Braise didn't make a distinction. So there you go. That would prove Rav Chama Bar Chanina's point. The answer is no, not necessarily. Shabbalabayis. Maybe the Braise is only talking about ones that belong to a Balabayas. But maybe the Braise is not addressing ones that belong to an Oman. So the question is, Aval Shal Oman Mai Ein Metzalfin. So what are you going to tell me that you're going to say that the Braise is saying that ones that belong to an Oman, you can't move on Shabbos? If there is that distinction, when we say that the only distinction between tan and untan ones is only relevant as far as the dinim of truma, instead of that distinction, the Braise could have mentioned a distinction between untanned skins themselves, or tanned ones for that matter. When are you allowed to move them? The Shabbalabais, only if they belong to a Balabais, Avashal Uman Loi, but not if they belong to an Uman. The fact that the Braise doesn't make that distinction seems to show that there is in fact a distinction. The fact that there is in fact no distinction, which is what Rav Chama said. I mean, it's not necessarily, because you could say Kula Babalabais Kamaibi. It could be the whole Braise is only talking about skins that belong to a Balabais. It's not even addressing the case of skins of an Uman. So therefore, within skins of a Balabais, there's no distinction, but the Braise is not necessarily addressing a different case, which is where they belong to an Oman. Okay. The Gemara says Ketanoi. There's actually a Machlokas Tanoim on that subject. Oiras Shabalabayas Metalpulin Oysan. Skins that belong to a Balabayas, you're allowed to move on Shabbos. Vishal Oman Ein Metalpulin Oysan. But ones that belong to an Oman, you can't, because they'd be Muktamachas Kesorin Kis. Rav Yossi says either way you're allowed to move them. So you see it's a machlokas tanoim. Tosfos mentions the halacha is like Rav Yossi because we have the concept ma'aser rav. We said before that not only Rav Yossi held that way in theory, but he also acted that way in practice. That he would tell them that even on Shabbos, bring over the way Tosfos learned it was on Shabbos, bring skins and we can sit on them. And therefore, we see that skins are not mukta, whether they belong to an omen or not. As opposed to other kinds of things. Like we said, as far as boards, those, there is a distinction where if they belong to an Oman who plans to sell them, then they would be Mukta on Shabbos unless he designated them before Shabbos for some other purpose. Okay. Since we're mentioning these three Chachamim sitting together, we started this Gemara with mentioning three Chachamim who were sitting together, Rabbi Yonasan ben Achinoi and Rabbi Yonasan ben Elazar and Rabbi Chanina bar Chama. The Gemara mentions another thing. Hodu Yosvi become a Boyelahu. These Chachamim were sitting together and they had another question. Not related to what we said before. The only connection is that it's the same Chachamim. Hoditznan August Malachas Aboyim Chodrach. Further on in Amos Sech, the beginning of the seventh day, in the middle of the seventh day, we're going to learn that there were 39 August Malachas. The question is, Kenegad, what is that 39? What does that number correspond to? In other words, the point of the question is Tosfos explains is you have a number of malachas that actually are very similar. When we get to the list of malachas, we're going to see, for example, there's a malacha zoda, which is winnowing, where you take the grain mixed with the shells and straw and whatever, and throw it up into the air, and the wind blows away the straws, and then you get clean grain. You have bora, which involves picking out the things you don't want, and then manually. You have merakid, which is sifting. All of those, for example, are very similar malachas. And there's not necessarily a logical reason to consider them three separate avos malachas. On the face of it, we should just consider one of them the av, and the other one the toldos. So why do we have that they're listed out as separate malachas?
So where do we get that? So it must be. In other words, Tosfos says, the point of the question is, evidently, there must have been some Kabbalah that the Chachamim had that there has to be 39 Malachas. And therefore the Chachamim had to break out certain Malachas in order to reach that number of 39. What is that corresponding to? It corresponds to the malachas that were done in the Mishkan. Every individual malacha that was done in the Mishkan counts as an av malacha. So in other words, in the Mishkan, when it came to the Gemara later on, the seventh set explains that the various malachas, the first 11 malachas on the list, which we normally think of as having to do with baking bread, the Gemara explains over there later on that actually they had to do with preparing the dyes for the Mishkan. Some of the dyes for the Mishkan came from plants. So therefore, they had to, the flask for the Mishkan came from plants and whatever. And therefore, they had to go through pretty much the same processes with those as you have to do with bread. You have to plow, you have to plant, you have to harvest, you have to refine them, you have to winnow them, or whatever, of the shells and whatever that are in them, et cetera, et cetera. So therefore, you wind up that all of those things were done in the preparations for the Mishkan. The Yerushalmi actually learns a little bit differently, that they needed all those malachas actually to prepare bread for the Mishkan, namely the Lechem Hapanim. Whatever the case, the point is, Rav Hanina bar Chama is telling them, every individual kind of malacha that was done in the Mishkan counts as an av malacha. Since in the Mishkan they had to do the separate processes of Zora and Bor and Merakid in order to get clean dye stuffs or whatever it is that they were doing, therefore those count as separate obvious malachas for us also. We'll talk soon, Rav Hashem, about the deeper connection. But actually, no, fine. Let's talk about now the deeper connection and explains in Chassidus between the Avodas of the Mishkan and Shabbos. I think we mentioned at the beginning of the sector is that the Mishkan, the point of making the Mishkan was lost before he's brought up Gidav Atachtonim, was in order to take physical items in this world and make them into a house for Hashem. On Shabbos, the world is on a higher level. The world is closer to El Kos on Shabbos than it is on weekdays. So therefore, just the opposite. All of the activities that had to be done on weekdays in order to take the world and make it into a Din of Tachtonim, on Shabbos specifically, we don't do those things in order to demonstrate that. And by that, we demonstrate that we recognize that the world is closer to El Kos on Shabbos, and that at this point, it's Hashem does the work and not us. In fact, we mentioned over here that all those malachas are boim chotzer achas, 40 minus 1. So why say it that way? 40 minus 1. Why not say 39? So one point of that is that we do the 39 malachas, and Hashem, so to speak, does the 40th malacha on Shabbos, which is to make all of our efforts during the week actually bring the world closer to El Kos. A similar thing, we say, by the way, we're now in Sfira, we say a similar thing about that we count 49 days of Sfira, and then Hashem does the Sirutu Delayla on the 50th and gives us the Torah. Anyway, so Rav Hanina bar Chama is saying that's the connection. Every malacha that was done individually in the Mishkan counts as a separate av malacha. Amalahu Rav Yonis and Rav Elazar. So Rav Yonis and Rav Elazar tells them a different thing. Kach Amar Rav Shimon Rav Yosi ben Makunya, Keneged Melacha Melachtoi Umelaches Shabbat Torah Aboim Chotrach. It corresponds to the number of times in the Torah that it uses the word Melacha. Altogether, there are 39 of them, and therefore the point is, when the Torah says about Shabbos, Loi Sata Kol Melacha, it's meant to be, in other words, don't do any of the number of things that of which it mentions the word Melacha in the Torah, which amount to 39. Tosfos mentions that he has to agree. He has to agree we learn it from the Mishkan, because otherwise what makes us say that this thing should be considered a malacha and not that? So we still have to learn from the Mishkan what is considered a malacha and what is not. But he says the actual number of 39 doesn't come by counting the activities in the Mishkan. It comes by counting the number of times there's malacha in its various forms in the Torah. Now, there is a huge problem with that, which is, Rabbeinu Hanan already pointed out, you don't have only 39 times malacha in its various forms in the Torah. Rabbeinu Hanan says you have 61. And later on, the Tosfos Yom Tov recounts and says actually there are 65. So where are you getting 39 malachas out of, why are you counting only 39 of them out of the one? So there's a lot of different answers. Rabbeinu Hanan says that you take out certain ones, for example, you take out the ones in Vayichulu, you take out those, because those are Hashem's work. You talk about, you take out the ones where it says that you should, the ones where it says you should do such and such, and then so forth, and he goes like that, and then figures out how you can exclude some, how the Gemara means to exclude some of them, and you end up with 39 that count towards the list, and therefore you have the 39 melachos. You have a huge number of different answers that are given by different achronim. And the Tosfos Yom Tov says that the Tosfos Yom Tov says you don't count the differently, that you don't count any of the ones that are tzivu. You don't count any of the ones where it says loisasa komalacha or komalacha savoida loisasa or whatever. You don't count those, and then you wind up with 39. And there's a half a dozen different other answers. A good amount of ink has been spilled on understanding exactly what the Gemara means over here. Whatever the case, what the Gemara meant was that of the various times that it says malacha in the Torah, there are 39 of them that count towards this, and those 39 represent the 39 of the small office. Okay. So the Gemara asks, Boy Rabbi Yosef, Vayyavai Habaisa Lassus Malachtai, Miminyonahu Oloi. Okay, when we have a pasuk, in Parashas Vayeshev, when it says that Yosef came home to do his work, is that pasuk, Rabbi Yosef is asking about Yosef appropriately enough, is that pasuk talking about, not talking about, does that pasuk count as one of the 39 or not? Amalei Abaya, Abaya says, what's the question? The Loisi Sefer Torah of Limni. Let's bring a Sefer Torah, start counting every place where we see it says the word Malacha in the Torah, and see if we have 39 without that pasuk, then we know it doesn't count. And if we say that then, and if we say that we have, that we only have 38, then that one is a 39. What's the question? Mi loy Amar Rabbi Babachana Amar Rabbi Yechanan loy Zozu Misham Ad Sheviru Sefer Torah Manom. Didn't Rabbi Babachana say in the name of Rabbi Yechanan that in a different context, that they didn't move from there until they brought a Sefer Torah and count them? In other words, they had a suffix on something, on how many of something is there in the Torah, and they actually brought a Sefer Torah and counted them. So why don't we do the same thing over here? Let's bring over a Sefer Torah and start counting every time it says Malacha. Where did that happen, that they actually counted every, that they counted in the Sefer Torah, to answer a question? Rashi says, I don't know where that is. However, Rashi says, maybe what it was is, we had in last week's parasha, we had the big Vav near the end of the parasha, near the end of Parasha Shemini, you have the big Vav in the word Gochain. The Gemara in Kedushin tells us that that is the middle letter of the Torah. And the Gemara has the question over there, whether, when we say it's the middle letter, do we mean there's an odd number of letters and that is the middle letter? Or do we mean that, that there's an even number of letters? And in that case, is that the last letter of the first half or the first letter of the second half? So Rashi says, maybe that's what the Gemara is referring to over here, that they actually brought, the Gemara over there mentions that actually we don't know the answer because we're not Baki in Haseiros V'Yaseiros. You have some words in the Torah written without a Vav or a Yud, or you have a Cholam or a Chiddush without a Vav or a Yud. Sometimes it's written with them. We're not so Baki where the Haseiros and V'Yaseiros are to be able to count and arrive at a correct determination. So anyway, but the Rashi says that maybe what the Gemara is saying over here is in connection with that. Anyway, so that's what Abai is asking. So why are you asking whether that pasuk is one of the 39? Let's count and see if we need it to be one of the 39 or not. The answer is, Amalei, Rav Yosef answers, fine, but ki kamasafali, the reason why I have a suffix is mishum dechtiv v'hamalacha hoisadayim. You have a different pasuk in Parashat Vayakel where it says that the people were bringing material for the Mishkan, and they had to tell them to stop bringing because we have enough. And it says, "V'hamalacha hoisadayim." The malacha was enough. Now, that one also uses the word malacha. So we have to figure if the question is "mimin yonahu," do we, so. Mishum dechtiv v'hamalacha hoisadayim. Now, there's two ways of understanding that pasuk. The word malacha in that pasuk could mean the actual work of building the Mishkan, meaning, in other words, therefore, so it would mean, v'hamalacha hoisadayim, the people who were doing work for the Mishkan, the people who were weaving curtains or not even weaving, the people, let's say, for example, who are spinning thread or beating out gold into thin sheets or whatever, they're doing exactly as much as is needed, no more. So in that case, then the word malacha over there means actual malacha. It means the malachas that they were doing of spinning or beating out gold sheets or whatever, they did exactly as much as was needed as was needed for the Mishkan. So Moshe told them we need exactly this much, and they did exactly that much, no more, no less. Now the problem is like this: altogether, Rabbi Yosef is saying, of the times that it says malacha in the Torah that counts for this purpose, there are actually 40 of them, not 39. So we have to leave out one. The question is, do we keep in the malacha hoisadayim, because we say it refers to the malacha that the people were doing for the Mishkan, and in that case we have to take out the one about Yosef. The ha, in that case, it would mean, why would we take out the one about Yosef? Because Commander Omar Lakas Surah of Nichna. Because you have an opinion in the Gemara and Sota that when it says by Yosef, by Yavar Abayis Alakas Malachas, this is he came home to do his malacha, and then Potiphar's wife tried to force him to sleep with her. So does it, now you have an opinion in the Gemara and Sota that actually Lakas Surah of Nichna. So when it says Malachi over there, it doesn't actually mean that he came into the house to do his work. It means that he came in intending, you know, fine, I give in, I'm going to do this with her. And then, as we know famously, Yaakov appealed to him, and he didn't do it. So in that case, then the Malachi HaHoyzadayim would count, and Vayobai Abayis Alasas Malachi would not count, because not referring to actual Malachi. Maybe the other way around. Maybe Vayyavai Abayis Lassus Malachim Minyonu. Maybe the Vayyavai Abayis Lassus Malachim from Yosef is part of the count, because it means that he actually came home innocently to do work, and then Potiphar's wife started nudging him. Vahai Vamalacha Hoysadayim. And then when it says Vamalacha Hoysadayim, it doesn't mean the actual work that they were doing. It means Hachika Amad Shlim Layabidda. It means that the task was completed. The task of bringing things for the Mishkan, which bringing things for the Mishkan in and of itself is not a malacha. If it involves carrying things through the Shasad Abim, then it is fine, and we're going to discuss that later in the Masechta. But the actual matter of bringing things for the Mishkan intrinsically is not a malacha. So therefore, so that's the question. In other words, we have 40 times where it says malacha. We know we have to exclude one of them. So which in those two, with each one of those two, it's not clear whether the malacha that it mentions in the pasuk is actual malacha, because one of them could be by Yosef, it could mean that he was actually going to, that he was ready to be mezaneh with Potiphar's wife. In the case of a malacha, it could mean that they finished bringing all the donations that they need for the Mishkan. Or it could be the other way around. By Yavai Abayis Alasas Malacha, it could mean that he came home to do actual work in the house. Vamalacha Yisadayim could mean that the craftsmen who were doing the work did exactly as much as they need to. So the question is, which one of those do we take out? What are the meanings of the psukim? The one says teku, we have to leave it unresolved. We don't know because, yes, one or the other of those psukim. We have to delete from the count, but we're not sure which one. One second. In a sikha that everyone's talked about, the idea, the deeper idea behind this is that, again, like we said before, about a barim kosher achas, there are in fact 40 times that it says malacha in the Torah, and we're saying over here in the Gemara we have to delete one of them. The deeper idea behind that is 39 of them are things that we do during the weekdays, turning the world into a jira b'tachtonim, and the 40th one is malachas shemayim. We said before the 40th one is what Hashem does, but another angle on it that Rebbe explains is that the 40th one is what we do on, is the malacha that we do on Shabbos, namely malachas shemayim of refining the world in a more ruchniyistic way, not by taking the physical objects of it and doing the 39 malachas on them to turn them into a jira b'tachtonim, but rather by working with the ruchniyus of the world itself to bring that closer to Elikos. Malachas Shemayim, the work of learning Torah, the work of davening, etc., that is the one malacha, that is the 40th malacha, which instead of doing on weekdays, now we do that on weekdays as well, but we do it on Shabbos all the more so. Okay, so the Gemara finishes off. Tanya, Commander Amar Kenegad Avodas HaMishkan, we learn a Braisa in accordance with the first explanation, that the 39 malachas correspond to the avodas of the Mishkan, the Tanya, we learn in a Braisa. Ein chayavin, a person is only chayav for chatos or kores or what have you, ela amalacha shakayetza b'hoitza Mishkan, only the kind of malacha that was actually done in the Mishkan. For example, Hev Zoru, they planted seeds to grow things that they needed for the Mishkan. The first I'm talking about doesn't necessarily mean they planted seeds in the desert. It means that seeds were planted. They may have bought the materials they needed for the dyes, for example. They could have bought ready-made from Goyim surrounding them, from Goyish traders passing through the desert or whatever. But the point is, somebody had to plant those seeds at some point. Therefore, Ba'atam Lechizro, therefore on Shabbat, you shouldn't be planting. You're not allowed to plant. Came cuts through, they harvested. Ba'atam Lechizro, so you're not allowed to harvest. Came hell with a crush in the Kautalagola. they brought up the wagons when they were loading up the boards and the Mishkan onto the wagons. They brought them up from the ground, which was Rosh Hashanah, to the wagons, which are Rosh Hashanah. So you're not allowed to bring anything in from Rosh Hashanah to Rosh Hashanah. They brought down the boards from the wagons to the ground, corresponding to that, so you're not allowed to take something out from Rosh Hashanah to Rosh Hashanah. They took things from one wagon to another, because sometimes you'd have a board was loaded up on one wagon and then they had to move it to the other one. So you're not allowed to transfer something by the same token from one Rosh Hashanah to another. What do you mean? What do you mean? You're allowed to transfer something from one Rosh Hashanah to another. The whole concept that you need an Eruv between them is Dirabanan. The answer is Abaye v'Rabbi, Dami Chavayu. So Abaye and Rabbi both say, Yitame, Rav Adar Ba'Ava, or Rav Adar Ba'Ava says, what it means is, Rosh Hashanah, Rosh Hashanah, Derech Rosh Hashanah. It means that you're not allowed to transfer something from Rosh Hashanah to Rosh Hashanah when it's going through Rosh Hashanah. Because that's how they did it with these wagons and these boards, is you have that if they loaded up a board onto one wagon and then they realized that there's no room for it on that one and they need to put it on the other one, they would hand it across to the Levium by the next wagon. Now, the point is the wagons themselves are Rosh Hashanah. The ground between them is Rosh Hashanah. So we see that they did that on weekdays when they were loading up and when they were loading up the wagon. Therefore, corresponding to that, if you have, let's say, for example, so you have you and your neighbor live on opposite sides of the street, and you want to hand something out your window, or you want to hand something across from your porch or whatever onto his on Shabbos, then you wouldn't be allowed to do that, even though it starts in Rosh Hashanah and ends in Rosh Hashanah, but it's passing above Rosh Hashanah, and you're not allowed to do that on Shabbos. Which the details of that we'll talk about in the 11th parak of Amos Echad, as the Shem. Okay. So that's that. Tomorrow we'll continue with the dinim of Hatmana and then go on to more topics about Mukta.
What's Lashon Dayim? Is Lashon Day?
Dayim is Lashon Day, exactly.
Dayim.
What?
No, not Yam. Day.
Dayim, yeah. Dayim means enough for them. So that's what we have to figure out. Does it mean they did, when they did the actual malacha, they were doing exactly as much as was needed for the Mishkan? So if let's say, for example, they needed 100 yards of thread, then they did that. They spun exactly 100 yards, no more, no less. Or does it mean, in that case, then the word malacha over there actually means malacha? And in that case, we would have to say by Yosef, it means that he didn't come in to do malacha. He came in intending to be mezaneh with Eishes Pekifar. Or does it mean that Bamalacha Isidaya means that at that point they had everything they needed for the Mishkan, all the task of getting donations for the Mishkan, which again, in and of itself is not a Malacha, was accomplished. In that case, then that wouldn't count as one of the 40 times, as one of the 39 times that it says Malacha. And therefore, it would mean that with Yosef, it means Lassus Malacha would mean that he actually came to do regular Malacha and then Potiphar's wife accosted him.
Sure.
Okay.
So, Moshe Shabbat?
Let's